Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, April 30th, 2015. Tonight's main topic, and this will be primarily what I talk about tonight, lightning-related atmospheric electricity related to earthquakes and volcanoes. Now, let me preface this by saying that not all earthquakes and volcanoes are related to electrical phenomena, in that the, say, electrical phenomena from outer space or whatever causes them. No, in the ground, within volcanoes, within the depths of earthquakes, which many times are 10, 20 kilometers down in the ground, there are many, many, many factors. In fact, geologists will be the first to admit that they don't know all of the factors. In fact, they don't know all of the fissures. They don't know all of the fault lines. They're constantly discovering new fault lines in, for example, San Andreas along the California coastline. What we do know is that volcanoes and earthquakes tend to concentrate in certain regions around the globe. And this is where the concept plate tectonics comes from. In a side note, as long as I mentioned the word tectonics, that's a term that has been widely accepted, that somehow the Earth plates are moving around and that they just move around. Looks wonderful in drawings in a textbook, but the reality is there's no force that moves these plates around. They can't identify it, they don't try to, but the end result is that what Earth is doing, the plate adjustments and the plate stresses, etc., are the result of jarring that occurred within the last probably 4 to maximum 10,000 years, when a large comet came by Earth and gave it a pretty good jolt, and that's where the plates slip over the crust over the mantle. There's kind of a viscous layer there. In fact, that's where the volcanic lava comes from that layer. But at any rate, the plates slide, and then there's a lot of adjusting that has to occur after these events. And that's what we're seeing now. Earth is relaxing from this major cometary event that happened within the past 10,000 years, possibly multiple events. And a very interesting thing happens, as long as we're talking about volcanoes. If you take the periodicity of volcanoes and cycle them backwards, like some volcanoes erupt every 75 years, some every 10 years, some every 120 years, whatever. And you take that periodicity and you cycle them backwards, they all meet at the Holocene period. That's where the death of the mass extinction of the mastodons, etc., occurred. So let me explain this again. And there are many things in nature that are cyclic. Let's take another, just an aside example, something a little simpler. The moon goes around the Earth every, say, 27 point some days, so just about every 28 days. And then the Earth spins on its axis every 24 hours, and then we go around the sun. But this is talking about lunar eclipses and solar eclipses. Now, the moon's orbit is on a tilted axis, and that's why many people think, oh, the moon's not where it's supposed to be, or how come the moon is way down there, or sometimes it's way high in the sky. That's because Earth's own axis is tilted 23.5 degrees, then the moon's orbital plane is tilted another 6 degrees. And so when you add these up, the moon can appear in the very different parts of the sky. But the point on eclipses is that every now and then, by rhythm, the moon's orbit where it crosses the ecliptic, that's the line between the Earth and the sun, the moon's orbit crosses there, and it also happens to just be at the same time between us and Earth, and that's when an eclipse occurs. If the moon is between us and the sun, then the shadow falls on Earth. If the Earth is between the Sun and the Moon, then the shadow falls on the Moon, and we get a lunar eclipse. We call it, when the Moon is between Earth and the Sun, we call that a solar eclipse, because then we can see the Sun's outline with the Moon, and it just happens that the Moon is the exact same size in the sky when we're looking, and that's quite an interesting phenomenon. It's almost like somebody put it there so that we would have a good view of the Sun and the corona, the region outside of the Sun. But anyway, back to the point. It's these cycles. It's that lunar cycle that gets the Moon between Earth and the Sun, the Moon between Earth and the Sun, whatever. And the ancients had a way of calculating eclipses simply based on these cycles. They didn't know about the orbits. They didn't know about the tilt of the orbits. But they could calculate, and through rhythms, they could calculate and foretell eclipses. Now, that's a simple example. When we're talking about the cycles of volcanoes, there are thousands of volcanoes on Earth, thousands of active volcanoes. There are many, many more inactive volcanoes. But if you take the periodicity, and this, it's not exactly 75 years. It might be 75 years plus or minus 10 years. And so it's not really known, but the estimated periodicity of the volcano, and you cycle those backwards in time, you will arrive where they all meet. All of those cycles meet at the Holocene period. That's when the woolly mammoths and the saber-toothed tigers died off in mass extinction. That's when men went back to the cave ages. And prior to that, we had a very advanced, highly populated Earth. And so anyway, that's a little a side note. But the end result is that Earth went through a major league jarring back there, the surface especially. And the gravity wave is going to affect the surface more. Why doesn't it affect deeper? Because that is a very compact, gravitationally bound system. And one physicist put it this way. It's really a rock liquid. And this is a very interesting concept, because the gravitational pressure is so great that if you had any space there, it would immediately crush the rock above it, and that rock would then fill the space, and the gas in there would become compressed, possibly some of it actually mixing chemically with the rocks. But at any rate, the point is that plate tectonics is a result of a jarring from outside the planet. It's not something that the Earth jumped up and did by itself. And you'll find that in standard Tier 2 fairy tale science, what I call simple Simon silly science, the Earth has to do all of these by themselves. And that's like the explanation for lightning and clouds above volcanoes. Okay, so back to the topic at hand. Where does lightning come from in volcanoes, up above volcanoes, and in the ash clouds that are moving off in the wind? Mind you, these are expanding tremendously rapidly. So even though there's a lot of hot particles in the clouds, they're expanding. They're not in tumultuous, violent, explosive in encounters in the cloud. They're expanding, so they're actually becoming cooler a lot faster. So where does the lightning come from? Okay, so I'm going to take you on a little tour of the solar system here, and all the way from the Sun out to the capacitor, the discharge of the local capacitor near Earth, the charging of the ionosphere, and then all, the path all the way down to the Earth where the volcano is, or a thunderstorm, a hurricane, and also earthquakes. Just a little aside note on earthquakes. Earthquakes are basically fissures in the ground that slide next to each other, and typically there's a lot of pressure there. So they're trying to move, the pressure is building up and up, and so what happens is they move very quickly. As I said before, there's not a lot of room to move down under the ground. There's not a lot of elbow space, let's put it that way. So when things move, it causes everything adjacent to move, and the wave, the reaction of this goes up to the surface, and that energy propagates along the surface of the earth in the form of waves, just like the moon causes tides that roll across the surface of the earth. Not a lot of people understand that. We all know about tides in the oceans, where the tide rises and falls, but a lot of people don't understand that there's about a 1-inch tide every day in the earth. So you're sitting there, you don't feel it, you don't sense it, but the earth actually rises about an inch and then it falls about an inch. As the moon is passing over us, as the earth turns underneath the moon. And so that velocity of that wave, of that tidal wave, is about 1,000 miles per hour. So it's a very slow rise, and it drops very slowly, even though the wave itself is traveling at 1,000 miles an hour. Why is it traveling at 1,000 miles an hour? Because the earth spins on its axis every 24 hours. The circumference of the earth is 25,000 miles, so that means that you, in the course of a day, you travel 25,000 miles in the course of 24 hours, and so does that land underneath you. So as the earth spins under the moon, literally the tidal wave that's in the land or in the ocean, in the water of the ocean or in the land, is moving at about 1,000 miles per hour. Okay, and so that the entire point there is that earthquakes many times are enhanced by this slight movement up in the upper crust of the earth and the surface of the earth. It's this constant movement it's like a pulsing, and it's something that can jar the earth loose, and any activity, any built up fault lines with pressure ready to release, those movements can be initiated simply by the presence of the moon on a daily basis. But the reason I'm mentioning this in a discussion of electricity is that those fissures are also the paths where the electrical currents pass. If you have electrical conditions in the atmosphere, ground is a term used in electronics. And when you wire your house with electrical currents, you put a ground rod down, and that's because any ambient currents that get into your electrical system in your house then will pass down to ground, and it's a literal term meaning ground, meaning terra firma, the land underneath you, and that's an electrical conductor also. But the point is that around earthquakes, many times you can detect electrical currents. It is said that dogs and birds can foretell earthquakes because they can smell the ozone. Ozone is a product of electrical activity. Ozone is basically O3. Instead of O2, you have ozone. It's got an extra oxygen atom in there. And it smells like it's that electrical smell after a thunderstorm. You have that electrical smell in the air. And so let me go back to the sun. And the reason I'm starting at the sun is because you have to understand where all this electrical activity comes from. Things just rubbing on themselves do not create electrical discharges flying out of clouds. It's such a ludicrous idea. So, okay, let's go back to the sun. The sun is a fusion engine. The fusion of the sun is in the surface of the sun, not in the core. And this system of hydrogen, deuterium, helium, which is burning, it's a nuclear fire in the sun, is the result of electrical discharges in the sun. Jupiter and Saturn are doing the same exact thing. Jupiter and Saturn are small stars. They're not planets. But I could go on about that all day long. Let's go back to the sun. The electrical discharges, let's look at the hydrogen in the sun. the electrical discharges which are ongoing. And by the way, in any fire, it's somewhat self-promoting. If you have a big pile of wood and you throw a little bit of kerosene on there and then you strike a match to that, okay, not much energy in that little bit of kerosene, certainly not much energy in that match. But that's enough to kick off a reaction where wood burns with oxygen and creates a large fire. Okay, so the sun is the same. You have these electrical discharges, which actually by Earth standards are enormous, tremendously powerful electrical discharges. And so this fire keeps the internal battery in the solar atmosphere charged, keeps the lightning bolts going, which keeps this whole fire burning. So it's a self-sustaining fire in the surface of the sun. It's not in the core of the sun, as standard science would want you to believe. The end result of this is that the surface, the chromosphere of the sun, this is the part that we see. The chromosphere is the part that's around 6,000 degrees and burns at about an orange color. It's an orangish color. The surface becomes positively charged. Now, this is a series of layers of charge. Outside of that, and measured, we completely understand the properties of the solar corona. It's a sea of relativistic electrons. Relativistic electrons. So they're moving at the speed of light, orbiting the sun. And this is a very strange situation because, once again, standard science cannot explain how you get relativistic electrons orbiting the sun, and they're much hotter than the atmosphere of the sun. How does this energy get it into those, and how and what mechanism keeps the electrons in place? Well, it is electrical, because the upper chromosphere of the sun is positively charged, and so this is basically a super atom. In fact, this is in my books, I talk about this, the properties of a superatom of a ball lightning, for example, is an example of a solar fusion condition on Earth. And so I'm not going to go into that right now. Hopefully I have a little time at the end of the show to talk about ball lightning. But basically, the sun is a superatom. Now, let me review. The surface of the sun positively charged the chromosphere. Outside of that is the corona, electrons negatively charged, moving around in relativistic speed orbits, trapped in the electric field of the chromosphere. Okay, so basically you have a neutral superatom. That's the conditions of the sun. But now what happens? As the fusion explosions occur in the sun, they look out and what do they see? The protons come out and they're being pulsed out of the sun, and they look out and they see a sea of electrons, an ocean of electrons. They are attracted to that, and as they come out, the magnetic field that's associated with this causes a hole to occur in the corona, the electron shield, causes a hole to occur, and that actually accelerates the protons out. Once they get outside of that, they resemble what is known as a Van de Graaff generator. Now, here's how a Van de Graaff generator works. You have an electric motor, you have a rubber belt, and you have a high energy electric field at the bottom, which is pulling electrons out of metal, throwing them onto the rubber belt, which is an insulator, carries them up to the top into a metal ball. And you have a set of metal fingers there which extract the electrons, and the electrons go out. And why do they want to move out to the metal ball? Because electrons repel each other. They're trying to get away from there. And so the same thing happens in the solar wind. Once the protons get outside of looking back at they've been accelerated, hey, all they can see is those other protons, and they're trying to get away. So they're expanding out, and they continue moving out in the solar wind. standard science can't explain what causes the solar wind. In their view of the sun, the solar engine is deep in the core. All it can produce heat. There's no reason for electricity because it would be, it's like electricity being generated in a cloud or within a cloud by some kind of hot mechanism. There's no method for it to get out. There's no method for electricity to get out of there, even if it were created in that by such a mechanism. And so anyway, there's no methodology for creating electric fields or electrical conditions or electrical potentials in outer space with the standard model. So they don't have a basis for this. In my model, the one of the major discoveries was that there's an excess current of protons in the solar wind. Now, current has many properties. It's the number of charges passing a certain point per unit time. And so it also is not just the number, it's the velocity. And so in any solar storm, it's well known that the protons are dominant. But scientists still concur that there is equal numbers of electrons and protons. In other words, that the solar wind is electrically neutral. And that's a religion. That is a religious belief based on faith. And they claim that they have measured this. Well, how do you measure electrical potential with a single spacecraft? It's impossible. The definition of electrical potential is the voltage between two points. How can you do it with one spacecraft? It's not possible. And let me just do a little side note on there. Okay, say you go out to the battery on your car and you have your voltmeter. And there's a plus terminal and there's a minus terminal. Typically, the minus terminal is connected to the engine, so that's the base. That's the so-called ground. That's the neutral of your car. And then all of the other services ride 12 volts on top of that, or 24 volts, or whatever the system is in your car. So 12 volts. Okay, so if you take your voltmeter and you take one lead from your voltmeter and you put it on, let's say, the positive pole of your battery, you know what you're going to measure? Nothing. If you take both leads of your voltmeter and you put them both on the positive pole of the battery, do you know what you're going to measure? Nothing. Zero every time. And this is so basic, I think that maybe we should get NASA scientists to get a voltmeter and go out and test their battery by putting both leads on the positive terminal and see what they get. This is what they're telling you they do with spacecraft. So absurd, it's beyond ridiculous. Silly science. And so, anyway, to measure voltages in outer space, you need to look for the symptoms of electrical fields in outer space, such as the discharge of the solar capacitor around any object, the planets, the moons, the small minor planet that is they're taking pictures of and not releasing. And, you know, that's just to make mention of that, the Dawn mission to Ceres, they have been taking pictures, not releasing them. Just an absurdity. But any object in the solar system will discharge the solar capacitor. So back to the sun, the protons are moving outwards in excess of the electrons, and they are building up capacitor. They go all the way out beyond Pluto. And let me just review this concept of the Van de Graaff once again, just the very top part. You have a rubber belt, which is an insulator, carrying electrons. The electrons are like basically stuck on the belt, and small quantities, not a lot. And then as that belt gets up to the top, there's a set of metal fingers, like a comb, that rubs against, literally very lightly rubs against that metal belt. And what do the electrons do? They want to get away from each other. Electrons don't like each other. Now, the metal comb is very simply has a wire that goes off to the metal shell. It's a perfectly spherical, round metal shell, very thin, many times made out of aluminum, just some metal. It doesn't matter what the metal is, but it has to be very smooth and uniform with no bumps, etc. And so why do the electrons want to go out there when there's more electrons already there? Well, that's because the electrons are sitting on the surface, and on the surface they try and repel. And on a spherical surface, as they repel each other, that means that they're trying to push farther and farther away from each other on a spherical surface. If you think about this for a minute, it's logical. They are trying to get away, but they can't fly off of the metal surface, not until they reach a certain voltage. At a certain voltage, they would actually start to fly off the sphere. And you can see this in a dark room with a Van de Graaff generator, one of these little tabletop kid toys that they use for laboratory demonstration. You can see the electrons migrating off and illuminating the region around the metal ball. And in fact, if you look at that, that looks just like what the solar corona is doing. It's bleeding electrons off into that region above the sun. And why do they become relativistic? Because they're part of the fusion explosions. They're coming out at relativistic speeds, but they look back and they see that positively charged chromosphere, and they go into orbit. They literally are orbiting the sun at relativistic speeds. So, at any rate, all of this makes sense from my point of view. From the standard science point of view, there shouldn't be any of this. They can't explain it. If you look up for explanations of lightning and clouds, they can't explain it. They actually admit it. They've tried to measure voltages within clouds. They can't find any. They've tried to measure the electric field in the solar system, and they fail because they only send up one spacecraft. You can't physically measure a voltage with a single spacecraft. How brain-dead stupid can these people be? But that's what science is today. That's Tier 2 science. Believe me, the Tier 1 scientist guys are not that dumb. They know what's going on, and they've learned a lot from my work. But, okay, so now we have the protons expanding out in the solar wind, just like the electrons would in the Van de Graaff bell. And just a little side note, you might be wondering, well, why protons in the solar wind? In electricity, when we have metal conductors, the electrons are the charge carriers. They're the ones that are free to move. But in a plasma environment, the positive charge and the negative charges are free to move. Okay, so I like to summarize things because for many people listening, it's very complicated. So I'm going to start from the solar atmosphere and move outwards. Okay, so in the solar atmosphere, you have electrical discharges, causes the fusion fire. The explosive explosions cause the electrons and the protons actually to come apart. The protons are fusing, remember, to create larger atoms. And the end result is that the surface, the chromosphere of the sun, is positively charged. The corona, which is just outside of that, the region outside of the sun, is a sea of relativistic electrons. When the explosions occur in the sun, the protons see that electron ocean sitting around the sun and are accelerated outwards. That the magnetic fields break open holes in the corona, and the positively charged protons come shooting out, and that's what we call the solar wind. So the solar wind then continues out. There are electrons in it also, but it's primarily protons that move outwards all the way beyond the orbit of Pluto, where they kind of subside, but in the process they push a lot of gases out from the inner solar system. So you have a held at bay out there, the nitrogens, the oxygens, many molecular species, larger species, dust particles, etc., being held out there. And that forms a giant positive pole of the capacitor. The sun at the center is negatively charged. And so this is the overall solar capacitor. It sometimes is stronger, it is sometimes weaker. Right now, it's in a diminished state. from what it was in the year 2000, when we were the comet Hale-Bopp during the 1990s did a good job of discharging a lot of the energy from the solar capacitor. When that happens, that energy passes back to the sun, increases the fusion fire, and so the end result is that, as with any fire, it subsides, and now we're in a low ebb of the sun cycle. I've talked about a couple of weeks ago, I talked about novas, that the sun, our sun is a very typical star, and when we look at novas or supernovas, these are stellar explosions, and then go back into the star charts and try and figure out what kind of star that was that blew up, they're very normal stars. They're not stars that were agitated or expanding or burning or abnormally. They're normal stars, just like our very own star. So I came to the conclusion that comets, the interaction of comets and that star, if you have a big comet come in that very quickly discharges that star's capacitor, kaboom, it's going to set off a solar fusion fire that's going to consume all of that fuel at one time. Kaboom, a supernova is where the explosion is so intense that it blows the entire star up completely. Remember that there's iron in the sun, there's other species, metallic species. In fact, all of the elements in the periodic table you would find in the sun being generated as the sun continually grows, ages, etc. Okay, so at any rate, enough about the sun, but this is the basis for the electric fields in the solar system. Now let's come back down to Earth. Earth is, you know, fairly close to the sun relative to the what I call the nebular ion cloud. That's the cloud of gas and dust held out beyond the orbit of Pluto by the solar wind. But like all the planets, we're discharging that solar capacitor. And here's what happens. Now, Earth, in that sense, is acting just like a comet. And you can read about the details of this in my books. But the end result is that the Earth is discharging the solar capacitor. We also have a moon, which is out in the solar wind and is independent. Every now and then it passes behind Earth. It is within our comet tail, so to speak, but most of the time the moon is free-floating out in the solar wind. It's its own comet. In fact, it has a sodium tail. Our moon has an extensive sodium tail because that's one of the primary elements in our neighborhood of the solar system. That's why we have salty oceans. Isn't that interesting? And, for example, I've often asked the question or stated the standard science cannot tell you why the inland oceans like Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Erie, etc., why are those freshwater lakes with fresh water? Why is there no salt in them? Why do we have other inland lakes that are not as big, or some lakes that are actually inland oceans that have very high salt concentrate? Because they occurred in different epochs of Earth's history, and the sodium input was different for those for that period of time. The Great Lakes were sitting under an ice shield for a very long period of time, and over the last 10,000 years, we had a pole shift. The North Pole, the old North Pole, was in the state of Michigan. Or in the state of Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. That's where the old North Pole was. And so when that ice cap melted, we call it the Laurentian Ice Shield, when that melted, it carried any salt that was accumulated away and left fresh water in those lakes. So that's an indication that they're very recent, that the lakes, the Great Lakes in the North American continent are very recent. Because there's no salt in them. There's been no salt accumulation. And that fine rain of sodium is coming in all the time. Our moon has a sodium tail, and that's because it's discharging the solar capacitor and attracting sodium. Once again, something that standard science cannot explain. Okay, so at any rate, in any discharge of the solar capacitor, the ions come floating in from the tail side, the non-sunward side, but the bulk of the electric current comes as an electron beam from the sunward side. The electrons are the primary charge carrier because they are lighter. They have less mass for their charge than the protons and ions and dust particles, etc., that are constantly coming in from the non-sunward side. So this leaves Earth with a net negative charge, and this charge is floating around the Earth. It's like a region around Earth. It, by the way, these are the this is the source, the infusion source of electrons, which are in the Van Allen belt. And that's constantly changing. The electrons grow in numbers and diminish in numbers, but that's the source of electrons that are in the Van Allen belts. The Van Allen belts are simply charged particles, protons going one way, electrons going the other way, that are locked in Earth's magnetic field. And, of course, the protons are at a different orbital radius because they have a higher mass for their charge. So at any rate, there's some dynamics, some physics involved there. But once again, standard science can't tell you where the electrons come from that fill the Van Allen belts. Well, my model, that's exactly the, there it is. There's the signature. There's the source. Okay, so getting down this whole discussion was to get back to the topic of electricity and volcanoes. Now, there are 17 batteries that I've identified due to the solar wind around planet Earth. But the end result is we have a charged ionosphere. The ionosphere is in the upper regions of the atmosphere. But let's look at a volcanic plume. Let's come back down and start talking about volcanoes. The volcanic plumes reach up like a thunderstorm and can get up to 100,000 feet in the air. Remember that an airplane, a jet airplane, cruises anywhere from 30 to 35,000 feet. That's very typical of a cruising jet aircraft. And this is why they can't fly around regions where there's where it's very difficult around thunderstorms. Pilots try and avoid thunderstorms, which also can reach heights of 100,000 feet. But for sure, they're not going to fly through a volcanic plume or the end result. Just a small amount of that dust can ruin a jet engine, kind of ruin your day if you're up in an aircraft flying through a volcanic plume. So remember when the volcanoes of Iceland shut down all the airports in Europe because that fine dust was blowing across into the flight paths, the flight patterns of the European airways. Okay, now let's look at the Earth. You have a ionosphere which is charged. You have two belts of charged particles going easterly. Those are the easterly moving jet streams. You have a westerly moving jet stream of electrons around the equator. And the end result is that when these layers are up, some of them are started about 7 miles up, and some of them go up to a much higher altitude. But the point is that at 100,000 feet, that's about 20 miles up. That's in the main thickest part of the atmosphere where all of this volcanic dust is accumulating, and that acts like an electrical finger. It provides a conduction path for current to flow from the ionosphere down through the volcanic plume. And furthermore, it's an electrical conductive path to ground. Now, what would happen if that electrical plume and the volcano, erupting volcano, were not there? The reality is that Earth's atmosphere acts as a capacitor. There's in any capacitor, if you study electronics, the most simple form of capacitor is two metal plates that are separated by a small distance. The closer those plates together, the higher the voltage is for a given amount of charge. And so the trick in a capacitor is you want to store as much energy as possible in that capacitor. But what happens? Irregularities in the conductive path between the plates can break down and cause the entire capacitor to drain through that one point. It's the same principle as the backyard bug killer. You have two high voltage electric plates, the bug flies between, and zap, it's enough to break down the electrical path, and that's where the electrical current goes, and that is what a volcanic plume is doing also. It's providing a nice conductive path from the ionosphere down to ground. So once this electrical current starts to flow, that also can enhance the volcanic activity, which is very interesting. Now, let's just go back to the ancients a little bit here. Can you imagine you're somebody from ancient Atlantis, and you know you're watching this activity and you're watching this atmospheric lightning? What they discovered was empirically how to tap into this. They said, all of this energy is there. And so that is where my belief is that the Tesla Tower and the extraction of energy from the atmosphere originated. The pyramids, I think, were used to extract energy from the atmosphere. They really had nothing to do with burial chambers, although they may have had burial chambers, but that was not the primary use. And there's a very interesting listener just sent this link in. Mexican pyramids, they have found vast quantities, and not just naturally occurring, but in vaults at the base of four now Mexican pyramids, mercury. And they go, well, it doesn't have any practical use. Well, let me think. Now, they didn't accumulate all this mercury and put it there if it didn't have a use. Mercury is highly poisonous, and possibly they figured that out if they used it for more than a short period of time. Of course, that was discovered by our scientific ancestors here, Michelson and Morley. They were doing they had a pool of mercury, and they floated a rock, and that's where they did the special relativity. The light goes, is not moving in ether, but it moves the equivalent velocity in all frames of reference. But Michelson-Morley experiment, those two guys died from mercury poisoning, not knowing, just like many scientific advancements, the Curies and many of the other people who studied nuclear reactions, etc., died because they were carrying samples of uranium around in their pockets, not realizing the damage that it was doing. But it's interesting that Mexican pyramids with mercury, pools of mercury discovered, and really they didn't make much of an announcement until this last one, which was very large, but of course in standard fairy tale archaeology, they say, well, didn't have any practical use. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, yeah, it had a lot of practical uses, and I suspect, as one listener commented, that it could have been used in the electric circuitry. When you're dealing with Tesla energy, you have to have a trigger, and the mercury would very nicely serve as a trigger to set up a resonant frequency to drive the tower. But at any rate, back to the concept of volcanoes. Okay, now that I've gone, this has been a long circuitous route to get down to the final concept of where is this energy coming from that passes through the cloud down to the volcano. Now the end result also is this electrical current then has a wonderful path, direct drive down into possibly 5-10 miles down into the earth, down into the magma dome. And so this could certainly be a form of extra heat. Now, there are two types of volcanoes that we classify on Earth, two primary types. One is the cinder cone volcano. These are the explosive types. This is the Calbuco volcano in Chile type, or the Chaitén volcano, which I have, by the way, a picture on my 30-year anniversary poster. And also the poster that I took to the 2009 American Geophysical Union meeting. And there's a cute story that goes along with that. I was at my poster session where I had a big poster, big colorful poster, and you can see pretty much the equivalent of that poster on my sales page. Just go down to the bottom of the blue table, that's the book table, and on the right-hand side at the bottom on my sales page, you will find a sample of the poster, the 30-year anniversary poster, and on that picture, there is a picture of the Chaitin volcano, and I talk about the lightning and the fact that the lightning is from the ionosphere. I'm at the American Geophysical Union meeting. This one happened to be in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, at the convention center. And up to my poster come a number of graduate students, and they're standing there, and I'm talking to them and explaining the work, and they're very interested. And lo and behold, along comes their advisor. And he's listening, and he goes, wait a minute. He says, the electrical charge in the volcanic plume is generated within, like thunderstorms. It's the agitation in within the cloud causes the voltage, and that's what causes lightning. And one of the students pipes up, and I already explained to him that the reason you understand it's not created within the plume or in the thunderstorm itself is because the electricity is shooting out of the cloud. If the electricity were created within the cloud, it would not discharge outside of the cloud because the cloud would remain electrically neutral. And so anyway, one of the graduate students turns to his advisor and he says, well, the electricity is coming outside of the cloud. You know, it can't be generated within the cloud. It's coming outside of the cloud. And the guy got really mad at him. And he said, this, you know, the electricity is generated by tumultuous activity in the cloud. And that's the way it is. And he made those students follow him away from my poster. Kind of a cute story on silly science and the pressure that these students are under to learn this ridiculous science. And then, of course, if you don't regurgitate that back, and you're not going to get your A or pass the course. So anyway, life in the big city. Back to volcanoes. Now, let me switch gears just a little bit to earthquakes. Back in the mid-2000s, I was working with some scientists from Russia. They were actually studying in Mexico. They were studying the volcanoes, the volcanic active volcanoes in Mexico, but also studying the earthquakes that went along with them. So they had instrumentation up on top, and what they were measuring was the atmospheric electricity related to earthquakes. And they realized that the earthquakes were correspondent with, cosynchronous with the electrical activity in the atmosphere. Now there's two parts to this. One is that the piezoelectric effect, the pressure in the earth itself, causes electrical effects, but the primary effect is that it came from the ionosphere. And once again, they were interested in my work because it explained where the electrical conditions come from. But because just by themselves, earthquakes are not going to cause lightning to go shooting up to the sky. And so basically they were actually measuring the effects that I had predicted in my work. Okay, let's look at hurricanes, let's look at tornadoes, volcanoes, earthquakes. All of these activities connect electrically to the ionosphere. And once again, that's not to say that all earthquakes are caused by electrical conditions. No, there are tensions that build up, and these can happen just by the normal movement of plates, plate terminations moving, or in the case there, you don't necessarily need a plate. You can have just simply tension building up within localized regions, fault lines within localized regions of the Earth. And so those can occur without interaction with the ionosphere. But also, we can have pulses, for example, a solar wind pulse, a very high impact magnetic storm, can impulse the surface of the Earth because Earth has magnetic fields locked up in the surface of the Earth. in nickel and iron primarily, and that magnetic pulse can cause those a jolt and actually trigger earthquakes. So all of these activities basically coming back to the very same original source, the fusion in the atmosphere of the sun. And once again, if you look at the core fusion model of the sun, which standard science puts forward, there's no way to have electrical conditions. It's a very constantly burning fire. By the way, in my new DVD number 4, one of the problems that I give the students in that course is to calculate how long the sun would last given the burning rate of the solar fusion. And it's, I walked through how to do this in the course, in the problem set, one of the 25 problems at the end of the course, on how to calculate the lifetime of the sun. And it turns out that the sun, with the core fusion model, could not possibly last 4.5 billion years. And that is the estimated age of our solar system. So clearly the theories that are being propounded today are patently false. They don't work. They don't add up. And they can't explain where lightning comes from. They can't explain, they just have this, like I call it, silly science. But now you understand the relationship in the solar system. Let's look at the volcanic plume around the Io, the moon Io of Jupiter. It has electrical conditions also associated with it. The moon Io of Jupiter is a very interesting case. It has a ring of sulfur dioxide, and so standard science says that this ring of sulfur dioxide is sputtered by solar wind and from the surface of Io, which is very highly volcanic. But it's just the opposite. Io is electrically charged. It's the same activity as a comet in the solar wind of Jupiter, the fusion-based solar wind of the fusion-based wind of Jupiter, and the tail is actually a strung-out comet tail attracted towards the minor planet, really Io, the closest moon of Jupiter, the closest of the big moons. And so, but it's very interesting because Io is highly electrical. It's a very new planet. And it's interesting because it's the innermost of the moons. How did it get there? How did a young moon get inside of the other major moons of Jupiter? And the answer is that as the planets are captured, or just like Venus, for example, ended up inside of Earth's orbit, when they start interacting with the other planets, they are in elliptical orbits and they're typically losing energy. And when they have their interaction with other planets, they typically lose energy, so they end up inside of the previously existing planets. And so you're building up planetary system inward, not the orbits are ending up inside the existing planetary orbit. So that's the case with Io. Even though it's the youngest of the moons of Jupiter, it's in the inside orbit. So it clearly had interactions with Callisto and Ganymede and Europa prior, gravitational interactions and, of course, electrical, prior to nestling into its current orbit. And it's still sporting a comet tail, which follows it in its orbit. So it's attracting, it's building up. And sulfur dioxide is one of the more common species of chemicals in the region around Jupiter. I want to switch for a second to volcanoes on Mars. Mars has quite a few relatively active volcanoes, but the largest is Olympus Mons. It is so large it dwarfs any mountain systems on Earth. It's so large that it sticks out of the Martian atmosphere. So this is it's the biggest volcano in the solar system. It even dwarfs the volcano at Yellowstone, which, by the way, is in the news. And I'm going to try again, if possible, to get an effort going to drain the lake out of Yellowstone. We have to do this for the for the survival of the human race. If Yellowstone, if that water drops down into the magma dome of Yellowstone, which it could do, they just discovered two new volcanic tunnels in the substructure under Yellowstone Lake. If those lakes, for some reason, have a rupture, there's an earthquake, and those lake, the water from those lakes start dropping down, vast amount of water, and that turns to steam, you can forget the human race as we know it today. There have been three major eruptions from Yellowstone in the last 200,000 years. All three of them were devastating, certainly to the local region for 1,000 to 1,500 miles around, and then also worldwide. There were worldwide mass extinctions. So for me, the number one priority is not dealing with the Mideast phony terrorism or something like that. We got to get the water out of Lake Yellowstone. And once again, once that starts to erupt, it'll be a plume that's, they say, 30 to 100 times bigger than the Calbuca volcano in Chile. Now, I want you to go to my webpage, look at the pictures at the top. Imagine a volcano 30 to 100 times that size in the western United States. It's something we cannot permit to happen. So once again, I'm going to try and make an effort. I don't know how to do this. We've already contacted the government agencies, the Senate agencies, the Park Service, the National, the Geological Survey, and my good friend John Moore tried to spearhead that. And all we got was just complete idiocy. These agencies are staffed by complete idiots. One woman's response was, "What's a volcano?" You know, it can't get any more, you know, what can I say? Just ridiculous. Okay, I've got about a minute left. I want to remind you to go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Your purchases support this commercial-free radio show, so I thank you for that. And I'm going to concentrate more on selling my books, my DVDs, my CDs, posters, etc. And so I'm very excited about the amount of material I got coming out. I'm already working on DVD number 5, so I encourage you to pick up DVD number 4, hopefully 1, 2, and 3 also in the process. And this is going to be a very special set of DVDs for me because I'm putting out very high-level material, and even on top of this, there's more material. But this is something that the general public can really grab onto, and also just for posterity. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.